What you're about to hear is an astounding UFO case. 2 years before the 1947 Roswell crash, in 1945, also in New Mexico, was another crash of a UFO. It was an incredible story. It turned into what is now called Trinity, the best-kept secret, the work by Paula Harris and Jacques Vallée. In a moment, they both join us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Paula Harris with us. Let me introduce her first, a photojournalist, investigative reporter in the field of extraterrestrial-related phenomena. She is one of the best. She is also a widely publicized freelance writer and author of a number of books on exopolitics, government disclosure, and interviews with pilots, military personnel, contactees, media personalities, and key players in the field of ufology. She puts on an annual conference in Nevada as well. Her latest book is called Trinity, the Best Kept Secret, that she wrote with Jacques Vallée. First of all, let's say hello to Paula. Hello, Paula.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
I'm looking great. Good. It was great seeing you at Conscious Life Expo, by the way. I had fun.
Yeah, it's always good to be there.
Let's introduce your partner here, Jacques Vallée. Of course, everybody knows Jacques' name because he is one of the best. He began his professional life as an astronomer at the Paris Observatory in 1961. While on the staff of the French Space Committee, he witnessed the destruction of the tracking tapes of unknown objects orbiting the Earth, initiating a lifelong interest in the UFO phenomenon. He arrived in the United States back in 1962, worked in the astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin, wrote two highly respected scientific examinations arguing for the extraterrestrial hypothesis, they called ETH, of UFO origins. In 1967, he received a Ph.D. in computer science from the Northwestern University, where he became a close associate of J. Allen Hynek, then scientific consultant, as you all know, on Project Blue Book, eventually concluding that the extraterrestrial hypothesis was too narrow to encompass the burgeoning UFO data. He conducted his own extensive global research, resulting in the Alien Contact Trilogy. A couple of his books include Passport to Magonia, Dimensions, A Casebook of Alien Contact, and the one that he co-wrote with Paula, Trinity, The Best Kept Secret. And if you've seen the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the person who is the Frenchman, Lecombe, is basically depicting Jacques Vallée. And I had the honor of giving Jacques a Conscious Life Lifetime Achievement Award at Conscious Life back in February. Jacques, good to have you. And you're in Paris, understand, right?
Yes, good morning.
Good to have you with us.
I had my first cup of coffee.
Excellent. And you're on with Paula. Say hi to Paula.
Hi, Paula. Thank you for...
Hey, Jacques, you're lucky it's morning there. It's night here.
Yeah, what time is it there, Jacques, now?
It's a little bit after 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock in the morning.
8:15.
Okay, great. Well,
in the morning.
We're going to have some great discussions here about the work both of you do, which is really as good as anybody in the world. But, Paula, let's start with you. Tell us about this case that occurred in 1945, because not a lot of people have heard about it until you and Jacques wrote the book, Trinity.
Well, it was a case that I had read about when I was in Italy. As you know, I lived in Italy from 1992, and then I came back to the United States in 2007. I had read about it in a journal about these two little boys, and at that time they called them Indian boys. They're not Indian. They're Hispanic, who had witnessed a crash. In other words, the vehicle went over their heads, and they witnessed the actual crash. And that it happened in 1945, about 13 miles from where the atom bomb had exploded. And I had read about it and never thought that I'd ever be involved in it. But when I came back to the United States, the son of the pilot called me and was talking about his father being involved in, before he, his father, before he retired, having been part of this crash. And I said, you know, I asked him questions, and he gave me Remy Baca's telephone number. And at that time, Remy Baca was alive because he's since passed on. And I called him in Gig Harbor, Washington. I also went there in person to interview him. And the two boys were Remy Baca, who was seven, and Jose Padilla, who was nine at the time. So it took me 9 months to get Remy to trust me so I'd get the details of what happened. And then when Remy passed on in 2014, I went to New Mexico, to Socorro, to meet Jose. And I have been working on the case for about 5 years, going down to New Mexico, gathering all the word-for-word testimony, because, you know, George, that's how I do it.
You're efficient.
Tape recorder and tape every word. So I had all this material, and then Jacques came along, and he was interested in the case, and we worked on it for another 4.5 years now, so it's 9 years that I've been researching the case.
Let's bring Jacques in here now. Jacques, how did you become aware of this case and then join up with Paula in this program?
Well, you know, it goes back to, of course, the enigma of all the crashes and the stories about New Mexico that, you know, I've heard all my life. And I never, and people reproach me for not investigating some of those cases. But I remember conversations with Dr. Hynek in Chicago, talking about all that material, but we could never get very precise, complete information about, you know, exactly where the cases were, what had happened, what were the, what could be actually analyzed. Because it's one thing to be amazed by one case, and it's another thing for a scientist to be able to actually work on it and contribute. That changed after a couple of books that hinted to new information about a case that had been very quiet, west of Socorro, west of that whole area, about an hour to the towards Arizona. And I went there with a couple of scientists, and we started studying that case, came back with actual material that we had dug up, and now, you know, things opened up a little bit, and I had a friend named Ron Brinkley who's helped me, whose family is from New Mexico, was very familiar with the territory, very familiar with the Indian side of the stories, and took me to Trinity, to the area around Trinity, and told me that there was a case there that had barely been researched and that we really should be doing more about that. He had gone and met Jose Padilla on his own to begin to document the case. That was the same case that Paula had been working on. Unfortunately, Ron was killed by a speeding car.
Oh, jeez.
But I continued, you know, he had told me enough that I had enough information to begin digging into it. And when I did, I realized that, yes, this was an unresearched, very early case that coincided with, you know, not only the end of World War II, but with the atom bomb.
And well, that's true.
All the scientific work that had been going there, it was, you know, intricately, you know, tied to everything that was going on in New Mexico and in the Pacific at the end of World War II. And I became fascinated with that. Heard that Paula had done, several years of work on the case, and I sought to contact her, and an investigator in Los Angeles put us in touch.
And Paula, Project Trinity was the code name for the first detonation of an atomic bomb back in July of 1945, wasn't it?
Well, it was the Manhattan Project, actually. It was it was Fermi and Oppenheimer and top secret scientists that went down there, and they tried to keep it top secret. In fact, the town did not know that there was going to be a bomb that exploded, and Jacques will explain it was not a test. It never was a test. It was an actual explosion of an atomic bomb, and they kept it secret because they thought that, you know, putting together, and this was Pandora's box. I mean, when you detonate a bomb like that, nothing on the planet is the same, as you know.
Right.
And when they when that happened, it caused a stir in that area and much, much damage. But those scientists kept it secret. And when they were there, everybody thought they were traveling salesmen. They didn't know what was happening with the Manhattan Project. Trinity is the actual location where it happened.
And is it unusual that it would happen in an area that they would do atomic testing?
Well,
go ahead, Jack.
I mean, in terms of the UFOs showing up in those areas?
Yeah.
Well, that's happened since then, yes. It seems that the phenomenon is very attracted to military activity. But, you know, that's not all. I mean, it would be a mistake to look at, for example, the cases over Nevada and so on, or rocket testing and so on, where people have seen or tracked UFOs. That's only maybe 10% of all the cases. But those are important to us because usually there is tracking instrument, there is radar confirmation and so on. So that's why those cases make it to the New York Times. The other 90% of the cases happen to, you know, farmers in their fields, and those don't make it to the New York Times. But those may be equally important.
Paula, this, of course, happened 2 years before Roswell, 2 years before Kenneth Arnold spotted his UFO sightings when he was flying his plane. Is there a significance behind that?
Absolutely, because when those little boys, and I said they were 9 years old, Jose and Remy was seven, they had no frame of reference. When they were looking for a cow that was going to calf, I mean, they were used to going out in the fields. They were used to driving their father's truck. They were used to doing this kind of work. And there was a thunderstorm, and it's so interesting, even the idea of the thunderstorm there, and then all at once this craft comes in, it takes out a part of the communication tower. The boys see the whole thing, and they don't know anything about UFOs. There's nothing on TV. There's no images anywhere. Kenneth Arnold had not coined the term flying saucer yet, because that was in 1947. There was no Roswell. They didn't know what they were seeing when they walked over to the crash site, which was about 3 miles from the communication tower. They were curious. They saw the smoke, and they walked over there to see a avocado-shaped craft that had a kind of a panel blown out of it.
Why did they wait so long to tell their story?
Because were smart. You have to go back to those days. If you go to some of the places that are, restaurants and little cafes and so on, watering holes in New Mexico, you still see posters from that time that, say, if you see something, you don't talk. You keep the secret. So people knew that there were spies in the area, the German spies, but also Russian spies. You know, the Russians were very fascinated with Project Manhattan. And we were allied with the Russians in those days, but that doesn't mean that all the secrets were shared. So there was intense intelligence and counterintelligence going on, and people were indoctrinated with the fact that if you saw something that could be military, you would not talk about it. And they were indoctrinated with that idea. And also they thought, well, there are two other reasons. They thought that this was very personal to them, that they, they were terrified by what happened. Terrified, intrigued, seduced, everything. It was an extraordinary event at an extraordinary time. 2 days after the capitulation of Japan, Most adults, especially adult men, were scattered all over the planet. You know, the army was still in Germany and hadn't come back. Most of it hadn't come back. And the Japan, you know, the war had just finished, and most men in uniform were still on ships and air bases all over the Pacific. That's why that it's hard for people today to put themselves back into that time. You know, that's why the kids were driving the truck. I mean, that's why they were in charge of the ranch. This ranch is very, very large. It's fenced. Somebody needs to keep the fences, you know, secure. Somebody needs to keep track of the cattle. The kids had binoculars. They had binoculars that were just as good as the army binoculars, because they had to read the brands on the cattle from a distance. And they knew that area very well. So people have, you know, critiqued our book by saying, come on, you know, you're telling that story in two little kids, that little kids make up anything. Well, in those days, you wouldn't make up stories. I mean, you know, I was born in 1939. So I remember 1945.
Yeah.
I was 6 years old in 1945. I can relate to those little kids, you know. I know what it was like in France. You know, you wouldn't talk. If you saw, you know, during the war, if you saw a German soldier, you would not look him in the eyes. You know, you'd try to cross the street. I mean, I was born in occupied France. And I remember the bombings. You know, my family house was bombed, and we, you know, had to run away, just like I see people running away from Kyiv in, you know,
Ukraine,
in the war with Russia.
Yeah.
And so those were the times. It's hard for people to get back to that. They are not just two witnesses of two little Indians, although they were excellent witnesses, and we can get back into that. We've analyzed all the transcripts that Paola had done, you know, of their recollections of everything that happened. But there were two, we found two other witnesses, and there may be more, who were adults. One was a bomber pilot who was coming in for a landing at Alamogordo. Alamogordo is the airfield inside White Sands. White Sands is an enormous area, which is why the bomb was, quote, tested there.
Yeah.
And he was told by the controllers to take a look at, as he passed north of White Sands, over a tower, because they had lost communication with the tower. That's a tower that, you know, as Paola was saying, the object hit on the way down. And so he circled that tower, saw the damage, so it completely confirms, you know, what the kids are saying. He saw the damage, he saw the little kids, and he saw the object in the bushes with smoke around it, assumed it was on fire. Well, it wasn't on fire. The bushes were on fire. But the object was essentially intact after the... it was a crash, but it was a controlled crash. It didn't blow up the way an airplane would have blown up hitting the tower. It was an avocado-shaped. It was not a flying saucer. In our book, there is, you know, we mention a number of cases in France, the case in Socorro that about which we publish things that have never been published before.
Hold on for a second, Jacques. We're at a break. I'll be back with you and Paola in just a moment. We'll talk more about this incredible case, Trinity, the best-kept secret, about a 1947 crash in New Mexico, and we'll get into some other crashes, too. Next hour, we'll take your calls with Paula Harris and Jacques Vallée as we talk about Trinity, the best-kept secret, an incredible UFO case. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Paula Harris. Her website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and Jacques Vallée, his website too, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. They jointly wrote the book called Trinity, the best-kept secret. And Jacques, why so many crashes? I mean, the crash in 45, Roswell in 47, the Cape Girardeau, Missouri episode. Why do they crash when they have this ability to get here from millions and millions of miles, assuming that's where they're coming from?
Well, that's yes, that's one of the key assumptions, that they come from out there. I think scientists today would say that there are many alternatives to that, that the, you know, space origin isn't the only possibility. But the fact is that when I talk to, you know, my colleagues in science or in the technology field, they say, come on, you know, why? They ask exactly your question. Why, if you had that kind of technology, why would you crash? And the you know, people have come up with ideas like maybe we interfere with their driving, their driver system, with electromagnetic fields, radar, you know, maybe that's what causes them to malfunction. Well, you know, there are just too many crashes, and yeah, it doesn't make any sense unless those crashes are intended. You know, it may be that the equipment that we see and that we pick up is a signal, is a secondary effect of something else. Maybe those things are expendable, and they are trying to get our attention. One thing that, you know, the ufologists who have looked at the case in New Mexico, at the Trinity case, they've all gone away sort of shaking their heads, saying, well, we don't understand, you know, what happened there and why it crashed and so on. And they miss one thing, that this was, again, 2 days after the capitulation of Japan, 4 weeks after the explosion of the first atomic bomb. And in the physics books and in the history books, people talk about the test of the bomb. You know, Oppenheimer and Enrico Fermi had invented, you know, the atom bomb, mm-hmm. and they needed to test it. And, well, in physics, when you do a test, you know, remember high school, you know, when the teacher shows you a test, it's a small thing with, you know, a couple of vessels and something turns blue and so on, and that's a test. There is no way you can do that with an atom bomb.
Either no. It works or it doesn't. You detonate it or you don't, right?
Exactly. And the bomb at Trinity was the same power as the bomb that reduced Nagasaki to ashes. You know, it was 18 kiloton. It was a full-scale bomb. It was the same, you know, the same power as the two bombs that were dropped on Japan. And to me, when I read that in doing the research for the book, you know, I had to brush up on the Japanese war, you know, the at the end of the war, after the capitulation of Germany, of Hitler, you know, the war in Japan continued. And it was a big question whether we should use the bomb
again,
or not.
Yeah.
And the bomb was full power, and then this thing shows up out of nowhere in the middle of an area that's, you know, watched by all the military systems, you know, including that tower at the top of the range of the technically. That ranch, that you know, cattle ranch, is within the extended territory of White Sands. So it is watched, it is guarded, and then this thing happens. It happens, and it neatly deposits the subject. It wasn't, again, the object, you know, Paola and I went there, have gone back there many times. We've looked at the terrain. We understand every, you know, everything that happened to that field. The object plowed a boulevard for about over a quarter mile down the hill, made a turn under power to the left, which is to the south, and then stopped against a berm, you know, in among the bushes there. But it had to do that under power. So its power system was still working, and it didn't lose its integrity. It didn't break into a lot of pieces. There was one panel, only one panel from the envelope of the object that was detached when it hit the tower.
And Paola, tell us about occupants. What do we know?
Well, I'd like to add something about your question about why they didn't talk. This case is so original because we have the location, we have the witnesses, we have an artifact. And the nine-year-old, after nine days, or I think it was a week, that it took the Army to clean that up, the two little boys are watching this whole cleanup. And Jacques did an amazing job with the actual details of the flatbed truck and how heavy the craft was, and you know, the whole procedure. It's all detailed in the book. But, you know, on the last day, here's Jose, who wants the souvenir, and he you know, jumps on the truck, takes, you know, goes inside with a crowbar and takes a piece off the inside of the UFO and keeps it for 60 years. You think Jeez. You're going to talk about it? You know, no.
Probably not.
It was something that he had kept. The two boys, even though they split, ironically came together around 2012. They hadn't seen each other for all that time, so who would believe them? And, you know, when I was finally able to go on location with Jose, not only did he admit that he went and took something from the inside of the craft, he described these beings. He said they had long spindly arms, that they had, he thought they had a gray outfit, that they were gray, big heads. And Remy noticed their eyes. That's why he said they looked like a fire ant. He said their eyes were powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three of them, and they were, he calls it sashaying back and forth. And they were making a sound like they, like a crying baby, like they were in trouble. And Jose explains on location, I wanted to go in and help them, but Remy started to cry because also there all the brush was on fire and so forth. So their testimony of seeing these beings alive going back and forth is powerful. And there was nothing they could compare it to in those days. There was no movies. There was no, you know, there were no images. And so that's very important. The other thing very quickly Remy told me was that they gave him a vision of people falling out of skyscrapers. Well, there are no skyscrapers on that land. Remy, at 7 years old, had never seen a skyscraper. And there was some kind of psychic connection between the boys and the beings. This is all detailed in the book Trinity, so I think the listeners will be really interested in these details.
Was this a 9/11 prophecy, Paola?
That's what I get. We can only guess. We don't know. We can only guess. But that's what Remy told me. That was the vision that was given to him.
Take us, and Jacques has done a good job describing what may have happened, but take us, Paola, if you can, through the eyes of the witnesses in terms of what they're looking at when this is happening.
Well, they thought they were children. They called them omositos, little men, just like them, because they were, you know, as big as they were. And so they were, you know, as Jose tells me today, if he had gone inside, he probably wouldn't be seeing me or talking to Jacques and me. So he decided they just, you know, at a certain point, they were there for a good long time, and they had binoculars. And at a certain point, when the little one, Remy, started to cry when he was seven years old, he couldn't take it. So they went back home, told the father, and this is the funny part, told the father and Sheriff Apodaca what had happened. So, you know, then the sheriff and the father go back, and they go inside the craft.
Wow.
And then the Army comes to their door and said they have to take out a weather balloon. Well, the irony is, and this is funny, but it's in the book, people have to read it, that Jose and his father had picked up all kinds of weather balloons on their property. And they knew that they were not taking out any weather balloon because the Army, it was the Army Air Force at the time, wanted to cut the fence to take out this craft. And what Jacques has done, which is so amazing, is giving you the actual details, the scientific details of what you're looking at there.
Jacques, this is just a tremendous case, isn't it?
It is. And from a technical point of view, it's fascinating because we, you know, by reconstructing why they had to cut. See, there was a gate, of course, to the ranch, but the truck the army was going to bring was too big for the gate, where the cattle truck would go. They had to cut their own gate and build their own road, which took a couple of days before they could bring, you know, an 18-wheeler into the place to pick up the so-called weather balloon, and a crane. Well, you don't need a crane to pick up a weather balloon. And the kids were watching all that. The kids knew the territory. They would leave the horses some distance away, and they would stay within the bushes, and they were fascinated, and they took notes, you know, of every day, and they watched the entire recovery. The object, there was one time that when the object was unattended, at the very end, the object had been lifted and put on the side, on the trailer, the lowboy of the 18-wheeler, and it was going to be taken back to White Sands. The soldiers had nothing more to do. They went to get dinner at the local watering hole, and you know, which would take about an hour, and they were going to come back. The kids had that time to look inside, and Jose actually went inside, and that whole thing is fascinating because at that point they were able to get exact dimensions. They walked back and forth around the object, and so we have a pretty good detail of what it was like. It was like two pickup trucks put together. It was very high. It was about 13 or 14 feet high. And the floor was flat. So with Jose, we went over all the details of the dimensions, and he drew it. I mean, his drawing is in the book. And the floor was flat, so since the object was essentially round, like an avocado, there was space under the floor. There was no opening in the floor, and there was no opening on the underside of the object. Even when it was on the side, on the trailer, the kids then could see the entire underside of the object, which was round, and there was no hole and no protuberance from that. So if there is a driving system, if there is an engine, it has to be in a space that could be no more than 3 feet by, say, 6 feet,
mm-hmm.
with no opening. What kind of engine is that?
Exactly.
Because obviously the thing was under power when it arrived. And It wasn't some sort of contraption hanging from a balloon or something. It was, you know, it was a real craft. Paul. The question is, maybe we can talk about that next. You know, where would it go? Where would it be taken? Because nobody of the people I know about, you know, among investigators, army, you know, as you know, I worked with the Air Force at one time building databases for them. Nobody knew about that case. It's not in the Air Force files. So where did it go?
We're going to take a quick break for you, Jacques and Paula, and we'll come back and continue talking about your work, Trinity, the best kept secret. And, of course, we'll take phone calls. Just an amazing, amazing situation. Paula, when you were doing the research, how difficult was it to assemble all the research that you found?
Well, you know, all of my research is word-for-word interviews, so it's what the people tell me.
Yeah.
There's no part of my opinion in any of it. So I just took my tape recorder, like I do when I go around the world, and just record the what they say. And I found a third witness. In fact, Jack and I found this third witness, Sabrina, you know, Jose's niece, who had not only seen the crash site all burned years later, at least 6 years later, she had touched something that looked like angel hair. She called it angel hair that lit up because she said they decorated the Christmas trees with this stuff.
Sounds like fiber optics. Paula, hold on. We're at the break. We'll be back and talk more about this and take calls.